This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
I've got to tell you, I'm a huge fan of James Brown. I love the Live at the Apollo albums and so much more, but there's one moment, a 1964 concert on television called The Tammy Show that everybody's got to see, and it's on YouTube. It was an early point in his career, but everything we associate with James Brown is there. The energy, the yelling, the controlled wildness of his dancing, the giant haircut. It's 18 minutes, but it's a performance that perfectly encapsulates the title of James McBride's new book, Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul.
That's a higher, deeper tone. And it's different.
McBride is a musician, a teacher, a novelist, and he won the National Book Award for The Good Lord Byrd just a couple of years ago. He's now a biographer of James Brown. Jim, how did James Brown think about performance itself and the whole idea of, he uses the word, killing an audience in a short period of time?
Well, he was into soul and speed. Because he came up with that Chitlin' circuit where people were drinking and smoking and having a good time. They wanted you had to go to the max right away. So
there's no meandering.
Yeah, there's no fooling around. I mean, you're sitting in a juke joint, you know, in Birmingham somewhere, and Little Richard just finished burning the stage to cinders. You better bring it, you know. I think part of his expertise was that he could gauge an audience very well. And he knew the soft spots in an audience, and he knew when they were primed and ready for him to, you know, make love to them.
Mm.
And he would go at it hard. You know, he was consumed.
And a typical James Brown concert or show in the early days, in the peak days of the 50s and 60s, would last how long?
Oh, it lasts about 3 hours. It was like a Broadway show. You know, blacks didn't go to Broadway in the 50s and the 60s. James Brown was Broadway. He was more than that. He was the essence of African-American life.
Well, this is the thesis of the book and at the core of the book, and you're trying to impress on the reader how important James Brown and James Brown's music and achievement and life were to the African-American story. And why is that? Why is he so central and so kind of embodied this history?
Because he was so weird, and he was like the uncle who shows up from down south, who comes to your house, gets drunk, and takes out his teeth. And you're just so embarrassed when he does it, but you know he loves you and you love him. And James Brown really epitomized, you know, the country black folk that a lot of Northerners came from.
The stage move that James Brown had was the whole business of somebody coming out, his guy would come out with a cape and trying to rescue him from his exhaustion, and James couldn't go on any longer. And then he'd resuscitate himself and rise from the dead and do another minute of the song. And the whole stage act was amazing. I saw him with the Apollo, and he was 1 year from dead or something. He was still doing this thing that he'd been doing for, I don't know how long, 40 years. Where does that come from?
I think that he got it from the Pentecostal Church, United House of Prayer in Augusta. United House of Prayer, if you ever
had
the opportunity.
Church.
Yeah, it's a sanctified church. And the way they play music there is continuous, nonstop, with horns and everything.
Even during the sermon.
Even during the sermon. They just go at it, and they play. I've never heard anything like it in all my years on this earth. And they have these moments where people actually just lose it and, you know.
Possession.
Yeah, speaking in tongues and so forth, you know.
Now, even a modest fan knows that a big part of James Brown's music was a time. His attention to the one, the beat, the precision of the band. The most overused word in any discussion about music at a certain level is the G word, the genius word. Is that at the center of the genius of James Brown?
Well, I would say innovator or pioneer, certainly. I mean, a genius is someone like, you know, I consider a genius someone who has like perfect pitch and you can drop a quarter on the table and they can tell you the note. That's the kind of genius. Or Mozart or Coltrane. Well, he was pretty close. In terms of innovation and pioneering, he was an organic genius. He was an organic tomato.
Did he know it?
Probably not. Probably not. He didn't know what he was doing. He was like most creative people. He just said, this sounds good. Let's do this thing, you know. And also the other thing James Brown did that is unique is that his use of the guitar and the bass and the other instruments as they blended. If you pull out the guitar part to a James Brown piece and listen to it contrasting against the other part.
Because
it's
another drum or it's melodic aspect?
Because it's both melodic and rhythmic. And usually they're two guitars, and they play off against each other, and they make perfect sense. They used to call it the washing machine thing.
How do you mean? What does that
because
mean?
Because the old washing machines would make this and so the sound that he was trying to create was the sound of these old washing machines when all the parts were grinding together.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, one might be "Papa Don't Take No Mess."
So you're moving your fingers now like a saxophonist, which you are, by the way, have been a professional musician for a long time and a music teacher. When you try to play James Brown and the mode of James Brown, what's hard about it?
It's impossible to do it right.
Really?
Yeah. It's
why?
Not. Because the sound of that band cannot be recreated. I mean, you just can't get these kind. First of all, those guys grew up in the South. They grew up listening to Hank Williams and country and western and Louis Jordan. And they just had a blend of love for blues, country, and jazz that I don't. Secondly, they rehearsed all the time. Thirdly, they didn't have to read music or anything like that. They just played all the time. So the tightness of that band and the originality of that music is just beyond my ability to even ape properly.
John Coltrane played and played and played and played and played. Sonny Rollins, the same thing. James Brown worked really hard, and he worked his band mercilessly. And you even make the point in your book that he's pretty cruel to the band.
He was. He was tough. But again, the knife cuts both ways in that regard because musicians are hard to handle. Some of his band members were drunk. Some, you know, smoked pot, and some could play, and others, he had two trumpet players who could hardly play the instrument, but they could dance well, and he just, you know, he had a music director named Pee Wee Ellis who could shape all of these things. So he was smart enough to get the best cats and keep them with him as long as they could stand him.
Would you have liked to have met him?
No, I don't think so. I don't know if he, because if he didn't like you, he was like Frank Sinatra, shame on you. But if he liked you, you know. So I'm not sure if he'd have liked me or not.
One of the great chapters in the book discusses the relationship of Al Sharpton and and James Brown. And we're laughing because Al Sharpton has meant so many things over the years, and sometimes he presents as a serious figure and sometimes less so. But that relationship was essential to James Brown, and we kind of know a little bit of it. We go way deeper in this book. And what did it represent?
Well, first of all, I don't think people really understood that Al Sharpton is in some ways a creation of James Brown. Because when Al Sharpton was 17, you know, he got to know James Brown. He traveled. He left New York to go on tour with James Brown. And he left as a 17-year-old teenager. He came back as the Reverend Al Sharpton.
But he was a nascent preacher even before that, right?
He was a boy preacher, yeah. Who was a kind of a little, you know, low-level preacher here in New York at a Pentecostal church in Brooklyn. But he had done nothing. He was unknown outside the Pentecostal church. or the Apolistic Church. But every time you see Al Sharpton, you see him talk, you're hearing James Brown talk. He says it in the book, and he said it, you know, several times during
sermons, or just the way he—
No, just his whole approach to racism, white America, what black America needs, the business of injustice, all of that was, you know, James Brown covertly. James Brown would never say some of the things Al Sharpton would say.
Well, this is it. I mean, James Brown, sometimes you hear him give an interview, and or when you listen to him sing, it's more feeling than coherence, whereas Al Sharpton is all coherence. I mean, you understand exactly what he's saying.
Well, Al Sharpton was the guy who could talk for James Brown. I mean, James Brown was a brilliant guy. He was very smart, but he didn't, you know, the way he talked, you know, he was a little self-conscious about it. He didn't talk like a man with a formal education. Whereas Al Sharpton could spin it, you know, backwards. And Al Sharpton could go 360 degrees. He could swing with James Brown's henchmen, and he could talk to a president. And James Brown loved that about him.
James Brown's life was messy. It was a colossal mess. There are four marriages, let's just say not all of them happy. When he died, a huge battle over his estate ensued. I don't even know that it's resolved to this day.
Not yet.
Why did this happen? Why did he live in such a chaotic state?
I think he made a mistake when he left his first wife, you know, who was interviewed in the book. His first wife really understood him. And she let him go. She was married to him for 10 years. Really, technically, more like 19. But she let him go, and he never really recovered from that. Look, he knew he had done a lot of bad things in his life. He was a womanizer. He didn't treat his band that well. He didn't owe the IRS any money. And he didn't owe
anybody. He made a great IRS settlement. At a certain point, the IRS, which felt it was owed $15 million, settled for $1 million.
Right.
How did that happen?
Because he met a great accountant.
Yeah, I need that
good
accountant.
Good old boy from the South. Yeah, you and I both. He met a good old boy from the South who figured it out and fought the IRS on his behalf.
And he suffered financially. He felt that he was getting ripped off all the time by the record companies, not just the government, by the whole musical establishment. Was he right?
Heck yeah. All those old stars. Yeah. Aretha Franklin, too.
That's why she carries the pocketbook.
You know, Aretha's cash, you know, everybody knows.
All cash.
She's all cash. Because, you know, you turn on the radio, you hear someone playing ninth chords borrowed from your history or playing your song, you're not getting paid for it, you know. You know, it's hard not to be bitter when you hear, you know, these stories constantly about Nate Floyd Scott, who died, you know, James Brown guitarist.
With
James
nothing.
Brown's guitarist. He died. He was poverty stricken. He was blind. He had no money. He didn't complain. But he at least, you know, he should have died with a little something.
One point that you make in your book that's really clear and loud and clear is that so much of black musical history is lost or fumbled or rewritten. And this is a central part of American cultural history. It's a huge percentage of it is African-American music. Why the screw up? Why the fumbled history?
That's a difficult question to answer, but it's sort of typified by James Brown's life because he even fictionalized elements of his history because he felt white folks didn't care. As long as you could sing and dance, it was fine. I think part of the reason for it is that it's really hard to delineate what's white and what's black in music once it starts to get good. I mean, Tower of Power is a band that is like James Brown's band on steroids.
Right.
And they're mostly white cats. And they can, I mean, these cats can play, man. They really sound good. So you can't just say, you know, you're copying black music. But on the other hand, Jaco Pastorius, the great genius bassist, mm-hmm. had a is well known for a song called Chicken. Mm-hmm. That song was actually written by Pee Wee Ellis, who was James Brown's, you know, co-composer and co-musical director. Pee Wee Ellis can't make a living here. He has to live in London because he's totally unknown here. I think part of it is the media just can only accept a certain number of people when it has this category of black. I mean, the categories of music as it's sold in America by salesmen creates these categories that only allow certain kinds of people to flourish.
But James Brown did flourish in a sense, and so did one of his admirers and imitators, Michael Jackson. And Jackson makes an appearance in your book at James Brown's funeral.
That's right. He comes to the funeral. First, he spends the night with James Brown's body. He shows up around 11 o'clock at night, and he spends 5 hours in the funeral home with James Brown's body. And he never sits down. He's there all night. And then he goes to the funeral the next morning. And he's one of the few stars who showed up in Augusta, Georgia. He loved James Brown. They had a lot in common, actually, because they were both lonely men who lived in a place that few people understood. They were adored and somehow, in some ways,
and
disliked.
And mocked, too.
And mocked by the public. And they both wanted to be seen as proper people. Hair always combed, you know, always clean, always looking good. They always wanted to put forward their best face.
And Michael Jackson understood his debt. I mean, when he's doing the moonwalk, he's not trying to put it past anybody where that came from.
Oh, yeah. He used to say when he was a boy and when his mother played James Brown on television when he was 4 or 5 years old, he was just knocked down. He loved James Brown. He really – and also during the Victory Tour, when I first went out to L.A. and I was there for the first time, I saw this preacher standing out in front of Michael Jackson's house. And this guy said, "I'm here because James Brown sent me." And I was like, who is this guy? It was Reverend Al Sharpton. And he insisted during the course of the tour that he was there because James Brown sent him to help look after Michael Jackson's interests.
Thank you.
You got to have a mother for me. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
James McBride talking about one of the giants of American music, the late James Brown. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.